time for Susan Sims Smith, and a very interesting subject this time, addiction and dreams.
I'd like to start with a show of hands about how many of you have been affected by addiction. Either you are an addict, or you have an addict in your family, or you have been very directly affected by an addict in your work situation or your community. I don't mean I saw one somewhere in Itabena, Mississippi, or I heard there are a lot of them. I mean you have suffered. You have suffered because of addiction. So if you'll raise your hand, if you have had some suffering related to addiction. Okay, now hands down. And now let's see the hands of people that have not suffered from addiction that you're aware of. Okay? All right? Okay. Dreams and addiction. Ephesians, our struggle is against the forces of evil in heavenly places. Evil's primary way to have access to us is through our shadow, through disowned energies and unhealed places in the psyche. Not all the archetypes are friendly. Not all are sweet or kind or want to come to a table. Some are after the soul of the person. In addiction, the ego, the everyday decision maker, is not able to surrender to the self. The everyday ego collapses again and again in a destructive ritual. In the letters between Bill W., founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Carl Jung, whom Bill W. credits with helping him with the first step of the 12 steps, in those letters, the year before Jung died, Jung writes, "The craving for alcohol," and we might substitute any other addictive substance or addictive behavior, "is the equivalent, according to Jung, on a low level of our spiritual thirst for wholeness." Jung continued as he reflected on the power of darkness. "I am strongly convinced," Jung said, "that the evil principle in this world leads the unrecognized spiritual need into perdition if it is not counteracted, whether by real religious insight and experience or by the protective wall of human community. An ordinary man," Jung concludes, "not protected by an action from above or isolated in society, cannot resist the power of evil." Again, Ephesians, our struggle is against evil in high places, in heavenly places, battling for the soul of the person. Wherever your disowned selves are, that is the primary place that evil can have access to you. Now, that's another topic, but it fits into addiction. I want to say it again. Your disowned energies and unredeemed shadow material is the primary place that evil may have access to you. In addiction, evil loves lying, failure, despair, unconsciousness, and claps its hands and smiles at repetitive failure in addiction. Aha, another one under my web. Let's define addiction: the continued use of a substance or the engagement in a behavior, both because of its rewarding value or to avoid the negative consequences of stopping the behavior. The difference between a compulsion and an addiction, there's several differences, but one of them is in a compulsion, we feel driven to keep doing something. But addiction adds to that driven to keep doing it a pleasurable component, at least in the beginning. This can apply to tobacco, drugs, gambling, alcohol, food, and addicted love. I am a recovering food addict. The addiction started in my teens 40 years ago. And I work with women who are recovering cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, and alcohol addicts, women who are pregnant or who have just given birth. They live in a residential treatment program under the auspices of the Department of Psychiatry at the medical school called Arkansas Cares. We have dream groups there, and one of our participants, Joe Gibbons, is a ringleader in those dream groups. My dreams are helping heal me. Their dreams are helping heal them. Priests and prostitutes, therapists and strippers, addicts, all. The ego leveled to the ground with failure in addiction. My cost in this and my pattern would be I would gain 15 pounds and I would diet it off. I would gain 15 pounds and I would diet it off, occasionally 20, but usually not. That sounds like an innocuous pattern that many women in this culture have. Stay tuned for photographs from the dreams about how the soul feels about having its energy tied up in extra eating and dieting. Stay tuned for violent images about how that actually feels to the soul. The cost of the women at Arkansas Cares, prostitutes and strippers, their cost, murder, jail, rape, loss of children to the courts, and on, their dreams, I am at my own funeral. I want to give a brief snapshot of the current research on addiction. Of the five top addiction research people in the United States, we have gratefully been able to recruit one of them to Arkansas in the last 2 years, and he has brought with him an entire team of addiction research people and several million dollars of grants to study what happens in addiction. If you go into the MRI machine at the University of Arkansas and into that room, you might see a bunch of shrink types literally looking at the brains of addicts, people that are using cocaine under the MRI machine, looking at their brain, people that have stopped using it. So I want to give you just a little quick snapshot of the current research. First, in addiction, there are phases. The first phase is somebody discovers the pleasure of it, whatever it is. The second thing is that they keep doing it to avoid the negative consequences of not doing it. By that time, they're hooked. They started doing it for pleasure reasons, and something changes, and they continue to do it, whether it's compulsive shopping. I had a client one time that had plenty of money, but she was a compulsive stealer, and she got a charge out of it, and she did it because she felt like it was going to be fun, and she didn't want to stop doing it. So one, they do it to discover the pleasure of it. Two, they do it to avoid the consequences of not doing it, like withdrawal or anxiety. Third, and the last stage of it, is the brain begins to say to them, I need to do this so nothing will go wrong. If I don't do this, something will go terribly wrong. I want to talk just very briefly about the changes in the brain that happen in addiction. And I'm doing this for our information and also hopefully for our compassion. Because most of us either are addicts or know an addict, or after this talk, you may find yourself called to serve addicts that you do not even know yet. So a little tiny bit about the brain. If this is the part of the brain that we call the reptilian brain, and this is the mammalian brain, and this is the part of the brain called the frontal cortices, the brain literally changes in addiction. One of my dreams, I did not know this research when I had this dream, but about a year or two ago, I had a dream that said, the brain is scratched in addiction. And I took that as a way to remind myself that there is something so fundamentally changed and damaged in addiction that I need to be really aware as a recovering addict that my brain is occasionally going to tell me to do something that I absolutely do not need to do. Yes.
This happens even when the addiction is not to a substance.
Well, we know this is an evolving body of research. What we know right now is that it happens to certain drugs, it happens to overeaters, and it happens to gambling. Now, there are many, many other addictions that either have not been researched yet or I don't have the data. The data that I have is fairly hot off the press, but I can only speak for what I know. But I know that there is research that indicates that there is a change in the brain in gambling, there's a change in the brain in overeating, and there's a change in the brain in drug abuse. Okay, so let's just look at these brains for a second. First of all, the reptilian brain is the part of the brain that is physically deeply down in the brain. It could be called the lizard brain, the limbic brain, evolutionary brain. It is the same brain that we share with rats and pigeons. At that level of our physiology, we are a rat. We act like a rat, talk like a rat, treat our neighbors like rats. It's the same thing. This is the part of the brain that is associated with the necessities of life, air, food, water, safety. This is the part of the brain that, if it's deprived of air, starts to say, I need it now. I need it now. I have to have this right now or I won't breathe. The mammalian part of the brain is the part connected to social and emotional reasoning. And I'm not going to talk about that because it is not primarily kidnapped in addiction. Not that it's not affected, but you can't look at an MRI and see that part of the brain change. The frontal cortices, this front huge part of the brain that is big in humans and not big in other species, is what makes us different from a rat. Other than that, we're rats. We're just rats running around with a frontal cortex. The frontal cortex is large in humans. It has the executive function where we plan for the future and we think about consequences of our behavior. So we know in an addiction, somebody is doing something that they know is not good for them. And it reminds us of Paul. And Paul says, why do I keep doing the bad that I know not to do? And why don't I do the good that I know to do? It's the same question for the addict. One of the reasons that they don't do it is because this part of the brain that is where the ego actually has a chance to exist, this is the part of the brain that plans, thinks about the future, and thinks about consequences of our actions. That part of the brain literally is affected in addiction, and you can see it on an MRI. The frontal cortices, the planning part of the brain in addiction, goes offline, does not work right. So the part of them that is able to say to them, if you take this heroin, you might prostitute tonight to get more money for it. That part of their brain is not working right. It is literally changed. Secondly, the drug or other addiction commandeers and literally takes over the reptilian part of the brain that is associated with the necessities of food, water, and air. So the drug gets itself incorporated into the brain as if it's telling the person, you need air. You don't get that heroin, it's like not getting a breath. I hope your heart's open toward addicts because it's so hard to understand. Why would somebody go do that again and again? But if I ask you to hold your breath from now until lunch, how many of you are going to make it 10 minutes? It's the same thing. The part of the brain that says, I need air, I need air, I need air, has been commandeered by the addiction. So if they don't get to go do whatever it is, that part says, I need air. And the part of the brain that can think straight and think about the future is offline. So one part is saying, I got to have the drug, I got to have the drug, and the other part cannot override it. Because of this brain involvement, addicts tend to discount the future, which helps us understand why they make so many poor choices in the present. For example, this applies to tobacco. Somebody that is heavily addicted, if you say to them, would you rather have $1,000 now are $5,000 in a year. Their brain that can think about that has been commandeered. They would rather have the $1,000 right now. That is part of the fallout of addiction. And there's a whole field of research called behavioral economics research that is trying to intervene and help people with this. Addicts discount the future more than normal people. And they engage in behaviors that we would associate only with times of starvation and famine. We know if we do research around the world, people, not all people, because Eric Fromm, there's some examples of people who did not live like a reptile while they're in terrible situations, but they're not many. Most typically what we see around the globe is that starving people will sometimes prostitute themselves, steal, and kill. Drug-addicted people behave the same way. The same way. Our struggle is against evil in heavenly places, and evil loves addiction. The ego cannot surrender to the self. The self may be saying again and again, "This is what I want from you." And the addict's ego is not able to do it. The dreams, however, are loyal, hard-working, never-ending angels to addicts. A little bit more about Arkansas Cares. Some of you that were here last year, or maybe even perhaps the year before, know of my great love for this program. It is my belief that any place on planet Earth where people are gathered together who have been kidnapped by evil, and these women that are addicts and pregnant have been kidnapped, when they want to do a 180-degree turn, it is my total belief that the angels in heaven thicken the help around that place. Just like if you cut yourself and you're at risk of getting an infection, more white blood cells are sent to that area. So part of the reason we go to Arkansas Cares to do dream groups and to take the Eucharist is to help them. And part of the reason we go is because we're starving to stand by that many angels in one room. And any time you do a metanoia, a total 180-degree turnaround, the spiritual energy there is so thick. The women are so desperate, they're so truth-telling, and they're so raw. And the spiritual energy around them will knock you out of your seat and keep you awake at night. Dreams for addicts serve many functions, and it is so fabulous to watch how busy God is working on these dreams. Sometimes the dreams of addicts simply serve the function to say, "You're addicted, you're addicted, you're addicted." I'll give you an example. A woman in one of the Arkansas Cares dream groups, her first dream about this was a simple little dream that there was a man that kept breaking into her house and stealing her stuff, stealing her stuff, stealing her stuff. That is a sign of the addiction, the energy that is repetitively breaking in and taking the goodies out of her life. That is a dream that gives her a heads up about addiction. Other dreams show a fuller picture. And then some other dreams give you some practical ideas about how to get out of the addiction. Now, how way cool is that? That God has created part of God's relationship with us and with the addict, not only to say, "Caught by evil, caught by evil, caught by evil," and this is what it looks like, and this is the price you're paying, by making a movie in the dreams, and then being able to say, "Here's a way out, here's a way out." So let's listen to this woman's dream. The background of the woman: she was a stripper for 15 years, off and on, and she entered rehab after being raped outside of the club where she worked. At the time of the dream, she is pregnant from this rape and giving herself up for adoption. Now again, our critic could say, she shouldn't have been in that strip joint anyway. She shouldn't have been doing that, but she's an addict. She's stripping so she can get enough money to support her habit because her reptilian brain is saying, "I gotta have air, I gotta have air," and her frontal cortices can't think about the future. She's an addict because something greater than herself is going to have to come in and intervene. So here's the first dream. I'm pregnant. Now, she is literally pregnant, and she's also metaphorically pregnant with her new life. She's pregnant in every way you can possibly be pregnant. The good, the bad, and the ugly. So it's a loaded symbol. I am pregnant. I am in the club where I used to work. But I find that I cannot perform my exotic dancing the way I usually would because I am so pregnant. How fabulous is that dream? She is pregnant with new life. And she not only can't strip because she's too pregnant to strip in outer life, but she's working herself out of a job, girlfriend. That's what's happening. Because she's pregnant with a whole new life. In the club, this is still in the dream, one of my therapists from Arkansas Cares shows up in the strip club. And she respects me and admires me. And as I see her, I immediately stop dancing and wake up while I'm in the dream. Become conscious while I'm in the dream. So not only does she have an outer helper at Arkansas Cares, but she's developing an inner therapist, and she's waking up while in the middle of her addiction. God love her. I mean, it just makes me want to just give thanks and pray and help these people. Okay, second dream, same club, pregnant. I'm trying to perform a lap dance, but I can't do it because of my big belly. The pregnancy is continuing to interfere with my work. I used to be a really good lap dancer. Now, whoever says that dreams are an upper middle class female phenomena, look at all these fabulous guys and look at these people that dreams are pulling out of the ditch. The dreams are for everybody. Last dream. I love this dream. She now is beginning to get enough ego strength that she's going to make her first attempt to battle the addiction. This is the dream. So she's now been clean and sober for a couple of months. The brain is starting to work better. She's starting to have a frontal cortices that can think about the future. And she's starting to have a reptilian brain that's not saying, you've got to go get the drug. So this is the dream. I'm outside the same club. I see a group of men gathering. I'm surrounded by them, and I engage in a violent fight with one man, the one that I know was the rapist. I realize that he has thrown me in a ditch, but I am fighting hard. She's fighting the addiction. That's what the addiction, not only was she raped by an outer man, but the addiction raped her. And she's fighting the addiction. May God bless her and all of the women like her who are fighting for their lives and for the lives of their children and the men that are fighting for their lives related to addiction. In the book of James, James says, resist temptation, resist evil, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. She now has some strength to resist. She's fighting in the ditch. And she's being helped by a 12-step program, by psychotherapists, by volunteers like you and me that can go out there and put a hand out to these people. In withdrawal, addicts need to stay miserable for a while. And what I mean by that is during the period of withdrawal, their brain is still not working right yet, and it's going to be telling them, you need to, and they're going to have anxiety and withdrawal symptoms. They're going to have to stay miserable for a while till they can get far enough into the healing of the brain and enough healing of the soul and the psyche that they have a chance. And again, my dream said, in addiction, the brain is scratched. Prostitutes, strippers, lap dancers, priests. When my addiction started, I was about 16 years old. I very unconsciously used food as a way to cope with feelings. Now, how ordinary and boring is that? Most people do. Use something to cope with feelings. Sounds minor. That's a lie. Sounds like not a big deal. That's a lie. Because my persona cared about how I looked, I never let it get to be a huge weight problem. But then how much energy does it take to gain and lose 15 or 20 pounds? 15 or 20 years ago, I think it was actually about 15 years ago, I decided I would put as my primary focus to stop the eating addiction. How naive is that? I'll just get into therapy with the best therapist in the world on eating addictions and get this thing handled. I commuted to Canada for 7 years and worked with Marion Woodman on this issue. And I got tremendous help, but not all the way out of it, not because of any fault of hers, but because the addiction was so deep and so entangled with so many issues, it took the ego forever to get strong enough to begin to say no to the addiction. Eat for comfort, it would say. Eat to numb. It's so easy to take it off. You're young and you love to exercise. However, what does my dream say about it? Let's take a look. This is a dream from 1986. That's a long time ago. That is a long time ago. In the dream, I am back in the church agency where I worked in 1975 when I was right out of graduate school as a psychotherapist. And it is Halloween. A large, dark man comes in the front door, and he goes into the kitchen. The kitchen, often in a dream, is a place of transformation. He goes into the kitchen, and I go back there and discover that he is making candy for the children for Halloween, and he is putting heroin in it. And he is going to go out on the streets of Little Rock and distribute candy to children with heroin in it. I realize what he's doing in the dream. And I go to confront him. I say, I've figured out what you're up to. But he overpowers me. My insight is no yet match for his strength. I'm still physically captured by the addiction, spiritually captured, and psychologically captured. He towers over me. In the dream, I wonder, why have I not called the male policeman who lives next door to this building? And why have I not called the male minister who is upstairs? That's what I'm wondering in the dream. So you see little hints of who's going to have to come into the psyche to be able to deal with this dude. The shadowy intruder physically levels me to the ground. That's 1986. So again, the ego at that point could not surrender to the self. The self is making it clear, I want you to stop this, but the ego could not surrender to the self. Now, I'm going to do two more dreams because I want to point out, and again, these are dreams of 15 to 20 years ago. So they're showing me when I first start to really look at the addiction and start to commit myself to working on it. In addiction, the feminine and the masculine are profoundly wounded, profoundly wounded. You're going to see it in these dreams. As it relates to the addiction, they may or may not be wounded in other areas. They probably are, but they don't have to be. But as it relates to the addiction, the masculine and the feminine are very wounded. I want to just give a sentence or two about what do I mean about that. So if the feminine is connected to how we feel and our body and our feeling function of what we value and our sensuality and our intuition and our dreams and paying attention to synchronicity and listening to life as it is revealed through nature, if I were participating in the addiction at the time of participating in it, my feeling function and my feminine energy would be damaged. The masculine in addiction is profoundly wounded. If the masculine is a part of us that can think and think about the future and be logical and set a boundary, the addict can't set a boundary on their behavior. They're just going to rock and roll and keep doing it. So the masculine is wounded and the feminine is wounded. What you really want to have happening is that your feminine side and your masculine side are working together to help you individuate. And you need all of your healthy feminine and you need all of your healthy masculine to help you go the journey. But look at the masculine and feminine as it relates to addiction 20 years ago. Dream. This is about the feminine. I say to somebody in the dream, oh my gosh, this female friend of mine has been in a terrible car wreck. She almost died. She was so totally torn up inside from the accident that she bled and bled forever. Finally, she was sewn up by a loving physician. He did it almost forcibly, as if with great determination. It took a long, long time to even sew her up. The extent of her injuries were unimaginable. He stitched and stitched and stitched everywhere inside to make her stop bleeding. But some of the stitches are put in too tightly. She's almost totally stopped bleeding, except for a little hidden blood from her vagina. The women are horrified at the extent of her damage. A dream is a snapshot of how it is with the feminine energy as it relates to addiction at that point in time. And it's very violent and graphic and upsetting, which is why some people don't do dream work. They don't want to see what bad shape they're in certain areas. But you start pulling stuff out of your shadow and it's stinky. And it's damaged, and it's screwed up, and it's messed up, and it's beaten up, and it's on the floor, and it's not pretty, and it's not in good shape. So the feminine in the addiction, the feeling function is not working right. I'm not living my life at that moment based on how I'm feeling each day. I'm not connecting how I'm feeling. The masculine at this time, 20 years ago. Many people have been badly injured in a fire, but the one child who is damaged the most is a small, young male. That really fits with this brain stuff, that the masculine cannot think and set a boundary. And the masculine in addiction is the most obvious place of the damage. This young male's burns are so deep. He's been burned so badly that one of his hands is even broken. He bears the pain without much vocalization. The skin on his burned hand is taut. There is a female physician with short hair who is teaching him a series of hand exercises, and he repeats them and repeats them. The female physician turns to me in a rage and says, somebody should have taken better care of this young boy. So the feminine is damaged. The masculine is damaged. The addict is coming in the door and giving heroin to the poor old child. So 20 years, 50, let's say, I think about 15 years I've worked on this project. And I'm not going to go through everything I've done because A, we don't have time, and B, we're just not going to do all that. But if you just looked at a little summary of what has needed to happen for me to get out of that addiction, as much as I'm out of it, because once you're an addict, you're always an addict. I'll never be totally out of it. Maybe that's not true. I don't know. We'll see. Ask me later. So lots of work on family of origin issues, lots of therapy, lots of 12-step work, as if there is a huge spiral of healing. And somebody in Jungian psychology, and I don't remember who, gave this lovely quote that we all have little wounds, but we each have one central wound. That is our wound for life. And the more we minister to that wound, the smaller the wound gets, and the more whole we get. So eventually on this journey, instead of me thinking, how did I end up with this big old long hairy struggle? Eventually I began to see that most of who I am and most of what I have to give came from what I learned ministering to this wound again and again and again. So there even became an acceptance of the process. I believe that each of us in this room have some wound that is our journey wound. It's the wound that propels the journey and fuels it and keeps us going back for more growth. And out of that wound, the self is born. So there's this huge spiral of continuing to grow, continuing to learn, continuing to clean out stuff. So over the years, it has gotten easier and easier, but not finished. Last winter, I guess the unconscious must have decided, okay, She's healed enough and far enough along that we are now going to bump her up the food chain one more notch. Now, a little part of us goes, this is going to be it. This is going to be the end of it. Another part just says, don't worry about the end of it. Go the journey with me. So I began to have dreams that I was on methadone. Methadone means I'm not running around acting like an addict anymore, but it means I'm not healed yet. So I began to pray, heal me. You can do it. I'm little. You're daddy. You're mama. You can do it. I can't do it. You can do it. And a whole new level of information started. It was like when I said, I can't do it. I don't want to be on methadone. I want to be healed. I began to be downloaded with more dreams, more information, and a tremendous level of healing. Sophia, making the ego stronger, sending these messages. I began to dream at night that I was living in a smaller house. I began to dream at night that the war in Iraq was going to end. Now, people feel differently about the war in Iraq, but in my symbol set, it's a senseless war where a lot of energy is being wasted. So in the dream, my dad, who's in heaven, shows up and he says, Susan, you need to get out of the war in Iraq. You're burning up a lot of energy there, and there's a whole bunch of spiritual stuff we all want to teach you. You need to get out of the war in Iraq. And then he said, and return to simple self-care. And I felt like saying to him, Daddy, all my friends think I take better care of myself than anybody. They know I have to battle other people's jealousy about how well I take care of myself. But the self, the soul said, you're not taking good enough care of yourself. I don't care what anybody else says. Apparently, you need to take even better care of yourself. Let's talk about how. All the next of these messages, all from Sophia, either came in a symbol set of a dream or during meditation. One, you need more time alone. And I'm thinking, I have more time alone than anybody I know except a monk. You need more time alone, she says. Two, meditate on Monday until the mouth is full. Three, do 12-step work. Four, be aware that in addiction the brain is scratched. Five, eat nothing white, no flour, sugar, rice. Six, get out of Iraq. Seven, more simple self-care. Eight, overgive, overeat. Nine, addiction is a chariot for the devil. Well, that makes me not want to do it, girlfriends and boyfriends. I do not want to be providing by my behavior a chariot for the dark energies to land on planet Earth. Next, addiction is a way for Satan to rape you. 10, recovery has to be your first goal of the day. 11, no one can overcome addiction without getting set before exposure. So what actions did my ego take? More inner work, more boundaries, better self-care, more alone time. Now, I want to just give you a little snapshot of no one can overcome addiction without getting set before exposure. Before going into a situation where you're going to be tempted with whatever your addicted deal is, whether it's gambling or shoplifting or drugs or food at a party, unless you visualize and get yourself set before exposure to the addictive substance or behavior, the brain is scratched and it's going to say, you need to go do it, you need to go do it, you need to go do it. So you got to get yourself set, visualizing before you go in. How did it play out this spring? All right. A year or so ago, I was invited to be the keynote speaker for the women's conference at Camp Allen in Texas. And I said, I will come if I may have a room by myself and no red meat because I'm allergic to it. So I go, and I've been leading week-long retreats. People shouldn't have let me be doing it by how young I was when I started. I got out of graduate school when I was 25 years old, and I started leading week-long retreats by the time I was 26. That should have been illegal. I thought I knew what I was doing, so I did it. Anyway, I've been leading retreats for a long, long, long time, and this retreat at Camp Allen is the first retreat that I have led with no food messing around. It was so exciting. It's like, I hit a home run. I'm so excited. How did I do it? I have all these things that I just read to you in the front of my journal on all my dreams. I do my 12-step work. I do my meditation. I reread all these things that are helping me. When I get to Camp Allen, the really sweet lady that picked me up said, "And now we're going to take you to the cocktail party where you'll have a chance to visit with all 100 women." And inside, something's going, she got the wrong woman. That ain't going to be me. That's going to be some other keynote speaker that's going to the cocktail party. So my little kid is saying, "They're not going to love me. They're not going to ask me back." I'm saying, I don't care whether they ask me back or not. My life is not dependent on that. And my first commitment is recovery. It is nothing about pleasing them. My only commitment for today is recovery. That's the only commitment I have. And I'm going to be growing by leaps and bounds if I can get through this weekend with it. But I found my kindness and I said, that won't work for me. This is the hour that I have protected to go do my meditation. I will be there at supper. I go to my room, I unpack, I do my meditation. By the time I go to supper, I'm ready to be with the people. Nobody died. Nobody fainted. They still seem to have a good time. None of us are that important. We are all dispensable. So I said with kindness, I won't be able to do that. It all worked out. Through the entire weekend, I kept my ritual and my self-care going. I went to do my meditation. I took my walk. I did my 12-step work. I got up early enough. I worked on my dreams, and it was so unbelievable. Beside the speaker's podium, they put a bowl of chocolates, unwrapped. Do I love them? And that's, I mean, I can eat chocolate some of the time. There's no hard and fast, rigid, bad, weird rule. But beside the speaker's podium, there were chocolates. Every afternoon, they brought in trays of homemade baked cookies at the back. I navigated the whole weekend without any stuff that was not part of what I was supposed to be doing. It'd be fine for somebody else, but it was not. I left there, I was like, I cannot believe this is happening to me. Home run. Then I went to spend the night with a friend in Houston. All of the meals were in restaurants. Another home run. And I say to myself, it's over with. I'm finally cured. It's healed. I'm over with. Hang on. Just wait a second. One more home run before I strike out. About a month after that, I go to visit my mother-in-law who lives in a town about 2 hours away, and I'm really close to her. And she keeps food at her house I would never keep at my house, like a lot of Fritos and wonderful homemade chocolates. And sometimes when I go spend the night with her, because I love shrimp and I love chocolate, we have shrimp and chocolate for breakfast. We do, because she just adores me, and she wants to have for breakfast whatever are my favorite foods. That would be shrimp and chocolate. So I'm there, and I'm spending the night with her, and I'm just eating my healthy, regular stuff. And at the end of the visit, she says, "You're not going to be any fun anymore. Who's going to eat shrimp and chocolate with me for breakfast?" But I made it through it. Third home run. And I think, I'm on a roll. Maybe it's over. Maybe it's finished. Maybe I'm out of Iraq forever and ever. Okay, next trip. I was invited to go to Moe Ranch to a Presbyterian men's conference. 400 men. I'm the only woman on the program. I'm doing workshops on dreams. Richard Rohr is the keynote speaker. And I do my same negotiating before I go. I need a room by myself, and I need no red meat. So I get there. It's a long way to Moe Ranch. And I'm fairly worn out when I get there, physically worn out. And they take me to my room, and there's another woman in my room. And it's a piano player who is actually putting in a lot more hours than I am putting in. And I'm thinking, there will be no way that I can keep my recovery if I don't have a place to myself. I'm not able to do it. So I go to the person and try to negotiate for a room to myself. And she comes back in an hour and says, every bed in my ranch is full. We've had to turn men away. They're stacked on top of each other. The only place is in the bunk room. And there'll be men everywhere. I'm thinking, that's not going to work. I talked to my husband on the phone. He said, go get a room in Kerrville. Just rent a motel room. And my little kid says, I couldn't rent a motel room in Kerrville. They're going to think you're a prima donna. They're going to think you have special needs. And you're not working as hard as the piano player. You don't get a room in Kerrville. You can muscle your way through this. So the little kid has other issues that I'm going to tell in a minute. But she stops me. She gets too afraid. She won't let me have the room in Kerrville. So the first night I go to supper. What do they have? I had been warned. It's going to be beef. It's Texas. Fried beef steak and roasted pork tenderloin. I'm allergic to both. So I'm in a mess. Not because I couldn't have gotten out of it, but because another level of healing had to be done. I wouldn't let myself out of it. I could get out of it. So this is what happened. I don't do well. I don't like overeat just tons. I mean, it's not that kind of thing. But I eat stuff that I'm not supposed to eat. I don't feel well, and I'm back in the addicted energy. I go home and I do my meditation and I pray about it and I write in my journal and I say, what else could I have done? And I hear a little voice that says, you didn't want to go get the room in Kerrville because you didn't want to trigger your mother's self-hate. And I realized that when I was a little kid, I made a decision that I shouldn't take any better care of myself than my mom took care of. Now, I've had 7 years of Jungian analysis and thousands of psychotherapy. It keeps coming is what I'm saying. Your healing with your family of origin is eternal. And just don't be surprised. When you can get a piece of that stuff to wash up on the beach of the unconscious, don't say, I've already spent $50,000 to get this worked out. Just say, thank God, more stuff is getting cleaned up. Now, my mother is taking better care of herself right now than she's ever taken in her whole life. She would be thrilled if I'd gotten a room in Kerrville. To begin with, she wasn't there. She wouldn't have had to know. But she wouldn't even care anymore. This is old stuff. I'm going to trigger my mom. I can't take better care of myself than the other women. Something bad, really bad might happen to me. I didn't know that. That was constellated in the unconscious and had to be cleaned out and washed out. A journey, a process. Let's get ourselves out of Iraq. Whatever area in your life where you're wasting a lot of senseless energy being trapped in something, the self wants to say to you and to those that you love, there's more spiritual stuff to teach you. And your call is not in full bloom. Yours isn't and mine isn't. For those of you who are addicts, keep ministering to the wound. Use it as your journey wound on and on so that the wound gets smaller and you are harvesting more and more resources. As you harvest the resources to bring them to bear on the wound, you're learning about meditation and prayer and forgiveness and more about dreams. You're actually collecting with a magnet all of the powerful spiritual resources. Accept with compassion that the brain is scratched in addiction, but that the light shines in the darkness and can lead you and others on an amazing journey. Take up the whole armor of God that you may say no and help others say no so that you can fully bloom to the person that you were created to be. Amen.